Hello, I'm Sian Kane. Before you get started with this edition of the Books Podcast, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast. And what a wonderful time it is in the world of books. It is the week of the London Book Fair. We've had the Bailey's Prize longlist announced, which is always a reliable event for excitement and reading list revising. I am Sian Kane and I'm joined by Claire. Claire, you must be very pleased. It's Bailey's time.
I've been in such a state of excitement since last Tuesday when we had the long list, and they've cut it down from 21 to 16. And I think that it really shows that it suddenly you just think every book on this list I want to read.
Yeah.
And I've read five of them, Sian. It's confession time. How many have you read?
She's showing off. I've read three. it's much better now that it's 16 rather than 21, I think, because it was getting a bit unwieldy.
Yeah, and there were just always one or two books that you just think, oh, they've been put on there for worthy reasons, for the wrong reasons. And I just think every book of the five I've read and the others that I'm aware of, they absolutely have earned their place.
Yeah, well, I'm very excited about some of the ones that I haven't actually heard of. There's The Sport of Kings by C.E. Morgan, which I had not heard of before it was longlisted. And also Little Deaths by Emma Flint, which I have heard of because it was one of the sort of bigger books that got a lot of hype when it first came out. But it's kind of pleasing to see it recognised with the prize.
Yeah, there are also some really big hitters like Margaret Atwood and Annie Prue, and also people like Sarah Perry, whose Essex Serpent has been so much the book of the last year, really, through word of mouth and through support by booksellers.
Mm, wonderful.
I just think
Sarah
it's
Perry.
Great. And so my bedside table is now an absolutely appalling sight.
That Annie Prue alone is probably as big as your bedside table.
Exactly, a brick, as they call it in Poland.
We also we've had the lovely Sarah Perry on the podcast before, the absolutely wonderful Sarah Perry, and we've also had Naomi Alderman talking about The Power. And we've also had Rose Tremaine talking about the Gustav Sonata. But it's not all about girls in the news this week, because you've got a bit of a scoop, haven't you?
Yes, I've had such an exciting fortnight. I'm practically hyperventilating. I am interviewing Roddy Doyle later on today at the book fair, and his new novel, Smile, isn't published to September. But because of this, I have had a sneak preview. And I was reading it in the wee small hours over the weekend. And it was one of those moments when you suddenly sit up, bolt upright, and think, oh my goodness, this is bigger than I thought it was going to be. And he really puts the boot into the Irish establishment. Ooh. He deals with abortion, he deals with child sex abuse within the Catholic school system. So I mean, my goodness, that's a hot tatty. But I'm not going to give anything more away, because otherwise I'll be sacked and I won't ever be given another exclusive.
You won't be invited back to London Book Fair.
I'll never be invited back to London Book Fair, or indeed given another audience with Roddy Doyle.
But first, before we get to London Book Fair excitement, Claire, you spoke to Ayobami Adebayo, who is on the Bailey's long list.
Yeah, Susanna, my producer. Hello, Susanna. I picked this up and put me onto it weeks ago, and we've been very excited about it because it just seems that it's a voice that I particularly haven't heard before. And as people who listen to this podcast regularly will know, I do bang on about Nigeria a bit, but this is genuinely new to me. Ayobami, you have just been longlisted for the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction. Complete surprise to you?
Yes, absolutely. I was totally stunned by the news. So I'd gone to bed very early the previous night, and I think I woke up around 6, but I didn't want to get out of bed. And I noticed that my phone kept on getting all those messages, and I wondered, oh, what's going on? So I think about 7:30, I decided to pick up the phone and check who had been texting me or whatever. And then I opened my email and saw the Bailey's Prize is now following you on Twitter. And I said, I thought to myself, oh, what's that about? And then went on Twitter and saw it.
And where were you when this happened?
So I was in London in a flat.
Do you live in London at the moment?
No, not at the moment. So I'm in London promoting the novel, and then this happens.
And where do you live normally?
So normally I live in a city called Ilefe, which is about 3 hours away from Lagos, which is the part of Nigeria everybody seems to know.
This is the place in which the novel is largely set.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because it's not a city that's very well known. I had to look it up, and I do know my geography of Nigeria fairly well.
Yes, so the novel is mostly set in Ilesha, which is also 30 minutes from Ife. I think Ife is probably more known because of the university. And part of the novel is also set in Ife because Yejide and Akin meet while Yejide is studying at the University of Ife.
Let's just have a little reading from the book just to give a sense of the characters.
I sat on the bed, held my head in my hands and tried to breathe. I stayed that way until I heard Hakim's voice calling me. I went to join him in the sitting room downstairs. I wore a smile, not a big one that showed teeth, just a small lift at the corners of my mouth. The kind that said, "Even though you old people know nothing about my marriage, I am delighted, no, ecstatic, to hear all the important things you have to say about it. After all, I'm a good wife." I did not notice her at first, even though she was perched on the hedge of Yamatha's chair. She was fair, pale yellow, like the inside of an unripe mango. Her thin lips were covered with blood-red lipstick. I leaned towards my husband. His body felt stiff, and he did not put his arms around me and pull me close. I tried to figure out where the yellow woman had come from, wondering for a wild minute if Iyamatha had kept her hidden under her wrapper when she came in. Our wife. Our people say that when a man has a possession and it becomes two, he does not become angry, right? Babalola said. I nodded and smiled. Well, our wife, this is your new wife. It is one child that calls another into this world. Who knows? The king in heaven may answer your prayers because of this wife. Once she gets pregnant and has a child, we're sure you will have one too, Babalola said. Yamata nodded in agreement. Yejide, my daughter, we have thought about and slept on this issue many times, your husband's people and me, and your other mothers. I shut my eyes. I was about to wake up from the trance. When I opened my eyes, the mango yellow woman was still there, a little blurry, but still there. I was dazed. I had expected them to talk about my childlessness. I was harmed with millions of smiles, apologetic smiles, pity me smiles, I look unto God smiles. Name all the fake smiles needed to get through an afternoon with a group of people who claim to want the best for you while poking an open sore with a stick. And I had them ready. I was ready to listen to them tell me I must do something about my situation. I expected to hear about a new pastor I should visit, a new mountain where I could go to pray, or an old herbalist in a remote village or town whom I could consult. I was armed with smiles for my lips, an appropriate sheen of tears for my eyes and sniffles for my nose. I was prepared to lock up my hairdressing salon throughout the coming week and go in search of a miracle with my mother-in-law in tow. What I was not expecting was another smiling woman in the room, a yellow woman with a blood-red mouth who grinned like a new bride.
So that was Yejide getting one of the first of many shocks. This is a novel absolutely full of shocks. But it also sets up the basic family background, which is what creates this extraordinary situation she finds herself in. Explain to us about Iyamata and Babalola, who they are.
Okay, so Iyamata is Yejide's stepmother. Yejide herself has lost her mom. Her own mother died while giving birth to her. So Iyamata is the most senior wife of her father, who is sort of supposed to be a surrogate mother, but isn't quite.
So there are like four mothers she has.
Yes. So they're all those women who are stepmothers, who she's supposed to think of as her own mother. But many of them are quite cruel to her. So she had that difficulty coming up. And Babalola is Akin's relative. So the two of them have come sort of as representing both sides of the family to say that this is the decision we've reached and we're supporting the fact that your husband is taking a new wife.
And taking a new wife because Yejide can't have children,
Yejide,
there are no children of the marriage.
Yeah, so they've been married for about 5 years and they don't have any children. And because of that, because while monogamy is demanded of women, it's not expected of men. That option has always been open to Aki, and they feel that the time has come for him to take that step.
It's an extraordinary trick you play with this novel, is that the prose that you write in is very even-tempered and it's not hysterical at all. But the plotting is almost gothic. And poor Yejide. I mean, she suffers tragedy after tragedy after tragedy. And I was thinking, how can she do that to such a nice character? And I wondered to the extent to which you're driven by anger.
I think perhaps the process was actually quite painful, writing from a perspective. And I remember bits of it that I wrote, and I would have to take long walks to just feel a bit better because I'd sort of gone through this thing vicariously along with her. And I felt it was necessary because so much happened in, I think, a relatively speaking, short space. I wanted the prose to be even-tempered. I was very deliberate about not exclaiming about what had happened, because so much of it happens, and because the characters themselves don't know what is coming to them yet, they are not exclaiming about, oh, this is so awful, how have all of these things happened to us. I want to sort of move at their pace, at their own pace of discovery.
And at the base of it, it's not only about infertility, but it's also about the death of children. Mm. And you get this sense all the way through of what's expected of Yejide, which is just to pick up and carry on, and what it means to be the mother who loses child after child. Mm. Is this something that is in your experience? It feels as if it comes from a very deep place. You're only 29. You can't have had very many children.
I haven't had any, actually. I haven't had any. And quite fortunately, I think for my family, I don't have anybody who's close to me who's lost children. But I did have friends, two of them, who I sort of grew up with and who passed away. And I start thinking a lot about what their mothers must have gone through. And I know that my grandmother lost, I think, about three children of, I think, about the 10 or so she had. And I had a talk about it once. I think they were moving house or something, and some of the birth certificates were sort of found, and I'd never known about these people. So it became something that I thought about a lot. And because one of the friends that I lost, I kept running into her mother because we lived in the same community. And at one point, there was a day I saw her looking at me, and I could just imagine what was going on through her mind, because I spent a lot of time with her child and what it was like for her to look at me and not have her own child.
And the reason for the loss of the children is sickle cell, which is something that I believe you're a carrier of sickle cell. Will you just explain what it is?
So it's a blood disorder. If you're carrying the gene, if you have children with somebody else who carries the gene or who suffers from the disease, you will probably have children who suffer from the disease. And because it's a blood disorder, it affects everything, really. From the top of your head to your toe, if you have sickle cell, you have complications. Pretty much everything that people think is normal. One of the things that's pretty common is that sometimes they have strokes as early as when they're teenagers, and sometimes they have all the series of small strokes and have all sorts of organ damage and all of that. It's something that many people manage to live with because medical care is improving, but it's a very difficult disease to live with. And because I've had friends who lived with it, two of them have passed on now, some very happily are still very much alive. I've had the opportunity to hear them talk about what they suffer and how they wish that their parents had made a different decision. Even though they really love their parents and admire them, there's always
that... You mean
that
they hadn't married each other?
Yes, there's always that moment where they say, I wish these people hadn't done this to me.
Another of the things that is very striking about this novel is, although Yejide is really treated abusively in many ways, but she's not surrounded by bad people. You could say that her stepmothers weren't entirely loving, but that's in her past. But Akin, her husband, is not a bad man. And so you've constructed this sort of horrible scenario out of people who actually want the best for each other.
Yes, and it was something that was interesting for me to look at. Because, I mean, marriage is such an intimate relationship and families are so into each other. And the assumption, and I think the reality many times, is that people really do want the best, but it doesn't always translate into actions that bring out the best. It's that you make choices sometimes that have consequences you would never have imagined. And I think it's what happens with Haki and Yejide in particular, that it makes all these decisions hoping for the best, and then they turn out very horribly.
I mentioned at the beginning that it's sort of gothic. I don't want to give too much away because it really is a very heavily plotted novel. There are a lot of twists and turns which actually sort of make you gasp. And we absolutely mustn't spoil it for anyone. But so it's gothic, but it's also almost like Greek tragedy. There's a sort of relentlessness about it, and that everything is very heightened. And I wondered the extent to which that may be it also related to a tradition of Yoruba drama, which is very, very strong and which has its own tragic tradition.
Yes, so very interesting. I initially thought I would be a playwright because many of the writers that I knew and admired, Yoruba writers like Olaretimi, Wole Soyinka, were playwrights. And there's a very rich tradition of the Alarinjo Theatre, for instance, in southwest Nigeria. So there's a very strong tradition in drama. And now even in film, you have an old Yoruba industry out of Nollywood, where Yoruba is this language that's spoken in all these movies, probably hundreds of them released every year. And perhaps because of that, I still read plays a lot. I have a sensibility that is interested in that kind of vivid portrayal. When I'm writing, I imagine the scene. I think of it as a stage, and I'm a spectator, and I'm just trying to pay attention to what everyone is doing. I also obviously go into their minds, but when I really want to write, I really want to have a vivid picture of what's going on, as if I'm watching a play.
So what of the novel tradition in Nigeria? Do you feel you did your MA at UEA, the University of East Anglia in the UK?
Yes.
Which tradition do you relate to most strongly? Is it a Nigerian tradition, or is it an English tradition, or is it both? Is there a difference?
I think that I'm going to go with the writing tradition, which is a bit of a cop-out. But I'm quite heavily influenced, I think, by the Nigerian literary tradition. Because my first language is Yoruba, and it's a very metaphorical language. I say this very often, that everyday speech is almost literature. It's so rich. And it feels very often like a gift to me every time I'm writing in English, because I already have this resource that I can pull from. So I believe that that influence is very much there. And while I believe that the novel translates to anybody, I feel that someone who speaks Yoruba would connect and see some things that they would be able to identify. The way I felt when I was growing up and I was reading Wole Soyinka, and I could say, oh yeah, that feels like it's a gift just for me.
Is it actually translated into Yoruba? Did you write it in Yoruba or in English?
I wrote it in English, but I think that bits of the dialogue, because most of the dialogue obviously for me takes place in Yoruba, I would try to directly translate while I was doing the dialogue, because I wanted to still have not just the semantics but the sensibility, sometimes even the structure of the sentences, to still have them come through in English.
Yeah, and that's very striking in the writing, is that it feels very relatable, but at the same time there is a slight remove in it for me. You're very aware of people who come from a particular culture, which is partly to do with the extended family, which is different to our culture, but it is also to do with the pattern of the language and the speech.
Yes, and I think I'm glad that came through, because it was important to me while I was working on it.
So, 29 years old, you've written this sort of huge, great tragedy. It isn't a very thick novel, actually, but it packs an awful lot into it. What is coming next? Are you going to be more cheerful?
I remember when I think I was about 16. I started writing very early. So I was about 16, and I used to give my mother stories to help me. She would give our secretary at work to type it up for me. And I think she left one in her office. And one of her residents, she's a consultant, she's a doctor, and one of the residents read it and came to meet my mother the next morning. I was really upset. Like, how could that happen to those people? Who wrote this thing? And I think a couple of weeks later, my mother came to me and said, have you had an happy childhood? So I think for her sake, I would like to write more cheerful things going forward.
This Guardian podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
This is the week when the book world comes to London. It's day one of the London Book Fair, and I'm here with Jax Thomas, who's director of the fair, Benedicta Page of the Bookseller, who's going to tell us about all the secret dealing that's going on in the sidelines that we won't ever get to see, and Antonia Lloyd-Jones, who's one of the premier translators from Polish. And Poland is the guest of honour at this year's festival. It's not a festival, Jax, is it? I called it a festival. It's a fair. What's the difference?
Well, it's very much a business-to-business book fair where the business of publishing from all around the world is taken very seriously. So when you come into the book fair, you are met with this cacophony of noise and people, and you think it's absolute chaos. And then you have a good old look round and you see that it's, in actual fact, it's terribly organised because everybody is going to appointments every half an hour. And what's the purpose of those appointments? Well, they're all there busily selling the books that they've acquired as publishers or as agents, hopefully in translation to lots of different languages. So from English into French, from French into Chinese, from Chinese into Arabic, etc. You name it, those deals are done on very much a global level. And then there's a new dimension to the book, or a newer dimension to the book fair, which obviously reflects the age we live in, which is also selling books across formats. So going from a book through to an app, or obviously television and film, video gaming, one of the fastest growing creative industries in the UK, etc. So there's a huge amount of business being done, and also a lot of look-see to see what the talent is.
And for those who don't know about it, it's in Kensington Olympia. It's like this massive, great sort of ocean liner of a building with galleries and aisles, and it must be a massive construction business to get it all up and running, apart from anything else.
Oh, well, we start at least 4 days beforehand.
4 days to build
all
that?
Yes, it is actually done in 4 days. The organisation that goes into it is quite mammoth. And I always sort of liken it to building a small town, really. And then once it's done, it's this sort of tapestry of publishers, writers, illustrators, poets, people from all around the world. It's wonderful.
There are real people there, apart from all the deal makers, real writers.
Absolutely. We have authors of the day. We have a lot of other authors coming in to see their publishers, etc., etc. We have authors meeting their international publishers. And also we have a part of the fair completely dedicated to aspiring authors called Author HQ. And typically about 1,500 people come through the fair doors to participate in that exhibit over the 3 days.
Benedicta, it's always slightly baffling coming in off the street, as we do as journalists, you less so as the person who sort of knows all the deals that are going on. A lot of stuff seems to happen in the weeks leading up to the festival. So am I right in thinking that a lot of the big juicy deals have already been done?
Yes, it's a real mix, I think you can say. So a lot of wonderful buys are announced really just ahead of the fair, and they may have been done a little while in advance. But the point of the fair is that it provides a real focus where a lot of attention can be drawn to this. And of course, these big books can be taken out and then sold to the foreign language publishers, the international publishers at the fair. So, for example, just before this fair, we had some superbooks being announced. I was very taken by a new novel from Patrick McGrath, The Wardrobe Mistress, which sounds fantastic. It's set in 1947 in the theatre, and it's about a dark secret and the wardrobe mistress, the widow of a great actor of the day who dies suddenly, has to uncover it. And something like that, where that book is announced just before the fair.
When will it be published?
It'll be published in the autumn.
In English.
That's
and then,
right.
And then it'll be published in lots of other languages as a result of this fair.
One would hope so, yes. I imagine that the agents will be going out at this fair, the announcement having been made, everybody having heard that it's coming, the excitement building, and they'll be showing sections of the manuscript, I imagine, or maybe the whole thing, and people will be doing their deals. People who've maybe published Patrick McGrath before will be very excited. They'll be hoping to be repeat publishers with this novel. There'll be all sorts of things going on. And many, many other books, that's just one small example, many, many other books are announced just ahead of the fair. But then there is always the exciting deal making that happens actually at the fair itself. And usually there are a few manuscripts that become very, very hot during the fair. Everyone's looking to buy the book that is the famous phrase, maybe even cliche, the book of the fair. And it seems as though every year something emerges that a lot of people are very excited by, and, you know, bidding starts happening and so on and so forth. Sometimes the buy actually happens during the fair itself. More likely, it'll be concluded just after the fair.
Do you know what that book is?
No. It usually emerges during the course of the fair. There are sometimes agents who will send out a manuscript on the very eve of the fair, and you have publishers and editors who are staying up all night reading it and trying to get to grips with it and working out whether to put an offer in or not. But it seems to emerge as if by magic, and a certain consensus during the course of the fair that there's one book or other that a number of publishers are very excited by, and it becomes a bit of a chase to get it.
That's a bit like publishing in general, isn't it? In that
writ large,
sort of,
yes.
Yes, absolutely. The sort of serendipity in a way.
Do you know what it is, Jax, this book?
I couldn't possibly tell you.
You
if
do,
I
don't you? Your ears.
I think these books, as Benedicta says, come up as if by magic and rise to the top.
Mm.
And all book fairs have them, I think.
And since what ordinary listeners like me would be interested in is the books that we learn about at this occasion. Tell us about some of the others that we know about already. We know about John le Carré.
That's right.
New Smiley novel. How exciting is that?
Very, very exciting. It sounds really interesting take. So it's 25 years since the last novel that he produced that featured Smiley. And this apparently is going to feature, it sounds like it's quite contemporary, so it's a sort of bringing these old spies out of retirement, because it's a re-examination, perhaps from the very different perspective of today, of the kind of record that they have left behind them. So it sounds very, very interesting.
He must be about 105, George Smiley.
I haven't done the maths. It could be. He was always rather old, even at the time.
He was. I wonder how he's going to pull that one.
He's timeless.
Well, I don't know all the details. It may not be exactly contemporary, but definitely I understand there's an element of looking back with a sort of new regime of spy masters, sort of looking back and examining the record of those who went before, which I think is quite an interesting premise. It's one that we have seen around us in terms of, you know,
the benefit of hindsight.
The benefit of hindsight and changing mores as well, and changing standards. Yeah. So it sounds very interesting.
And the other I was really thrilled about was Jim Crace, because Jim Crace always threatens never to write another novel. And this year, this time I actually thought he was going to stick to it. But along it comes. Do we know anything about this?
I absolutely adore his
books.
Right, yes. And the last one, I think, was The Harvest, wasn't it? And that was about, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. What I know about it so far is it's called The Melody, and it's about a musician who's coming towards the end of his life, and he is living in the family home by the sea, and that is about as much of it as I know. I believe his publisher will be Picador in the UK, who published the last book as well, and that's about as much as we know so far. So we're waiting to hear more.
And we'll have to buy the book.
One of the things that the fair always does is it always, nearly always, although it didn't last year, has a guest of honour.
Yes.
It didn't last year because it got snarled up in international politics, didn't it? But anyway, we'll pass over that one.
Well, I think last year we also had the International Publishers Congress, which replaced the guest of honour. This year we are absolutely delighted because we've got Poland as our guest of honour, which is, I think, particularly exciting for the UK, given the size of the diaspora in the UK and the fact that Polish is the second most spoken language in the UK.
The second most?
Yeah.
Is that true, Antonia? This is where I bring you in, our Polish
well,
expert.
Well, that was discovered during the last census. So, yes, it's a remarkable fact. And all the Polish publishers who I work with come. And then the British and American, mainly, publishers to whom I'm trying to sell Polish literature are there. There are a whole lot of translators, and we have a very strong translation community in this country. And the London Book Fair is unique for having the Literary Translation Centre and for having special panels and discussions for professional translators, which is an absolutely fantastic feature.
Is that to do with Norwich, the Translation Centre in Norwich, or is it completely separate?
It's partly initiated by the Translators Association, which is part of the Society of Authors, and by several other organisations, the Arts Council, and partly Writers' Centre Norwich, and then it has some funding from Amazon, and Penn are involved, and also the Free Word Centre. There's a whole group of organisations that are involved in promoting literature across frontiers. We all come together to organise the Literary Translation Centre. And then this year, I have the additional joy of having a lot of Polish authors coming over and Poland having a special focus, which is, it's like Christmas. It's a dream come true.
So who are the writers that we should be all looking out for?
Well, there's some absolutely fabulous Polish writers coming over. There's a delegation of 11 authors. And Olga Tokarczuk is going to be author of the day tomorrow. She's the most fantastic, talented novelist. She's written a range of books. Every book is slightly different. She's just reinvents the novel every single time.
She's just had a film, Agnieszka Holland has just directed one of her novels, and it was premiered at the Berlin Film Festival, wasn't it?
Yes, that has been given the English title Spur, which is, of course, frightfully hard to say. But the book that it's based on has a title, which is a quote from William Blake, which is, "Drive your plough over the bones of the dead," which is a quite fantastic title. In Polish, it sounds like this, "Prowadź swój pług przez kości umarłych."
It is such a beautiful language, isn't it? So it's quite an... She's quite political, isn't she? It's a sort of animal activist.
Well, this is an extraordinary novel. She wrote it partly when Poland suddenly had a wave of interest in crime novels. And Olga's always been a novelist who doesn't stick to a kind of obvious structure. She's always rather bucked the trend when it comes to what you might expect from fiction. And in this case, she's written a much more structured book, which is a sort of pastiche of a crime novel, but it also makes some very interesting points. And her main character is a woman in her 60s living in a small town in a rather remote corner of Poland. And there's a series of rather bizarre murders in this area. And this woman keeps trying to convince the police that the murders have been committed by animals in vengeance against people who hunt them. And of course, she's dismissed as a batty old woman who doesn't know what she's talking about. And so part of the book is about animal rights, but it's also about a certain kind of chauvinism, not just towards women, but perhaps towards women of a certain age whose greyness blends into the background and therefore they get ignored. But it is a big mistake to ignore such people, as you will find out if you see the film or read the book.
It touches on the political seismic shift that's happening, not just in the UK. Brexit is obviously of concern mm-hmm. to anybody in Europe, but also all over Europe, all over the other countries as well. How is this impacting, Jax?
Well, at the moment, obviously, this month is the month that Brexit will be triggered, et cetera, et cetera. So it very much is on the agenda, clearly. Publishers are no exception. We've got seminars debating the whys, the wherefores, and the hows and the whats of Brexit. We've also have another one that I'm eagerly anticipating, actually, which is looking at the children's market, which clearly will look at education, the more primary variety, and that's on Thursday, which is our Children's and Cross-Media Day.
One of the lovely Polish books, or I met a couple of Polish authors who did this book called Maps, which is, I have to say, I have subsequently seen it in loads of British bookshops, but I had never heard of it.
I translated
before.
That book.
And it's huge. It introduced a whole new format, a whole new possibility of size for books.
Well, this is a book which is by a wonderful couple who are children's illustrators and writers, and their names are Daniel and Alexandra Mijelinski. And is it an A3 book that opens out to maps, which are illustrations of countries, but they're all done to different scales. So each map is across a spread of the book, which makes Belgium as big as the United States, for instance. So it's rather an unusual approach.
And fascinating politics in the book. And they were telling me about how they did two editions, one in simplified Chinese and one in Taiwanese. Well, the Chinese don't admit the existence of Taiwan. So they're doing an
atlas. Taiwan's now in the new book.
Where countries disappear according to where they're going to be published.
There's a new edition coming with 16 more maps. I've just translated the new map labels, and it includes Taiwan.
This might sound slightly intimidating to people who are not publishers, because you have to get day passes and things like that. But there is also Book and Screen Week, which you've rather cleverly created around it, where lots of these writers go and talk at ordinary London venues, but outside Olympia, so it's not part of the ticket. They can
well,
go
that's
to
very much the
events.
Festival element, in fact. So the London Book Fair is, as I said, business to business. I mean, anybody's welcome, but I think they'd have a better time meeting these authors as part of London Book and Screen Week. And all of the Polish authors are going to be appearing at the London Review of Books bookshop during the week, and they'll be appearing at lots of other festivals, which the British Council is brilliantly organising in the next couple of months.
And Olga and Zygmunt Miłoszewski, is that correct pronunciation?
Just about.
Because they will be appearing at the British Library, and I am chairing it.
That's
so I'm going
right.
to have to brush up my translation
well,
skills.
Well, Zygmunt's name does cause some dyslexia, unfortunately, but he has a great way of explaining his name. He always says it's Miłoszewski. Ski.
I'm going to go and have a little bit of a practice before I head to the British Library. But Ben, I want to bring you in. You're a journalist. You're an ordinary person. What is your experience arriving at this huge, great thing? What do you do? Did they make good coffee?
Well, it is a very busy time for us because the bookseller produces daily editions, which are handed out and distributed on the very morning as everybody comes into the fair.
So you've already produced your first
one. So we've already produced our first one, and we hope we've managed to pick up the hot news that everybody needs to know.
So you're going around and seeing these huddles of publishers and saying, excuse me, what are you talking about?
Exactly. We're rushing around trying to find out what that book of the fair is that I mentioned earlier, what people are talking about, what issues are coming up. Obviously, we are expecting that there'll be quite a lot of issues around the political environment, and we're really interested to know how those play out this year.
And one of the trends that's eagerly anticipated, really, at the fair, you've mentioned the political environment, is the rise of satire, which seems quite appropriate in the 350th anniversary year of Swift.
Well, I think everybody is trying to work out quite how to publish into this slightly changed environment. And there are different ideas about, you know, which way taste is going to go. Obviously, a lot of publishers are responding immediately to the rapid political changes of the last few months. So they're bringing out very quick books, which have quite a few have been signed up in the last couple of weeks. So, you know, Robert Peston, Matthew D'Ancona, Brendan Cox, The Widower of Joe Cox. Mm. Lots of books that are very, very engaged and that are being signed up and are coming out quite quickly. But how are people going to respond in the longer term? Are people going to be signing up big escapist reads set in other worlds, fantasy, historical fiction, anything to get away from the troubled present? Or are we going to have really in-depth, engaged analysis? And if so, will it be published into a completely different world if it's scheduled for this autumn? What will have changed by then? So there's going to be a lot of things to emerge, I think, over the course of the week in terms of what people are wanting to buy and what they think everyone is wanting to read.
Claire was talking with Jax Thomas, Benedicta Page and Antonia Lloyd-Jones, and of course Ayobami Adebayo, whose Bailey's long-listed novel Stay With Me is out now, published by Canongate. Next week we have Mohsin Hamid on the need in this crazy world of ours for radical optimism. He'll be talking with us about his new book Exit West. In the meantime, here at The Guardian, there are a huge range of podcasts that we make, and we'd like to spread the good news. This month, we're featuring Token. It's a weekly podcast about marginalised identities, and in rather an excellent way. Leia and Freddie ask questions like, and Claire, I'm going to put it to you right now on the spot, is it okay to be a little bit racist? And what are offensive questions?
Oh, gosh.
They bring fresh light to old tropes, and to listen, just go to theguardian.com/podcast. Which is where you'll find us too. By searching for Guardian Books Podcast, you'll find us on theguardian.com, on iTunes, on SoundCloud, or by swiping and tapping on your smartphone. Just open up your favourite podcast app. And you can join the conversation too, either by commenting on the Guardian website or at Guardian Books on Twitter. But for now, from me, Sian Kane.
And me, Claire Armistead.
And our producer, Susanna Trezillian, over there in the corner. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.